I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, clashes in Kenya. The parliament building is on fire amid new protests over a government tax proposal. Pro-life provisions. Lawmakers consider spending bills that include funding for abortion. We're on Capitol Hill. Protecting children. The Supreme Court is set to consider a major case on transgender surgeries for minors. We have analysis from Mary Rice Hassan. And a brush with beauty. We take you to a remarkable event in Rome, which honors artwork from Salvador Dali. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, the Oklahoma Supreme Court has blocked St. Isidore Catholic School from becoming the nation's first religious charter school. The court says that the state school board's narrow approval last year violated the establishment clause that prohibits the government from making any law respecting an establishment of religion. One justice said, quote, under Oklahoma law, a charter school is a public school. As such, a charter school must be non-sectarian. Legal challenges are expected, and the case could come before the nation's highest court. All right, let's bring in Rick Garnett, professor of law and director of the Notre Dame Program on Church, State, and Society. Rick, thanks so much for coming back. We appreciate it. So what is your reaction to the court's ruling today and its interpretation of the Establishment Clause?
Well, the ruling's a disappointment. The court, with all due respect, got it wrong in at least three different ways. So first, the Oklahoma court interpreted its own state constitution to require discrimination against St. Isidore. And this runs squarely contrary to Supreme Court precedent from just a couple of years ago, a big case called Carson versus Macon, where the Supreme Court said states are not allowed to use their own law as an excuse for discriminating against religion. And that's what the Oklahoma Supreme Court has ratified here. The Oklahoma law has permitted funds to go to religiously sponsored institutions in some instances in the past, but not here. And it permits all kinds of nonprofits and indeed for-profits to run charter schools, but it's singling out St. Isidore for exclusion. So that's wrong. They're also wrong when they characterize St. Isidore as a state-run school. It just isn't. It's a school that Oklahoma is contracting with in the same way that, you know, local cities often contract with private folks to pick up the trash. And that doesn't make St. Isidore as part of the government. So, you know, the Oklahoma court got the Establishment Clause wrong on that one as well. And then finally, the court suggested that the federal Establishment Clause doesn't permit local governments to engage in contracts for public services with religious institutions. And we just know that's false. I mean, public funds have been used at religiously affiliated schools, universities, hospitals for decades. So it was kind of a three strikes and you're out, as far as I'm concerned, for this ruling.
Yeah, Rick, and one of your colleagues at Notre Dame, John Meiser, has been quoted as saying, in part, this is unconstitutional discrimination against religious educators, that is, and the children they serve. Would you agree? How do you see this?
Well, I certainly agree. And John is one of the lawyers who's on the case. I'm not. I'm commenting only as an observer. But John and his team of our students were actually participating and helping to represent St. Isidore's position on this. And I think John hits it on the head. I mean, Oklahoma has a program, a charter school program, that permits all kinds of entities to submit proposals for charter schools. St. Isidore was one of them, and the proposal they submitted was excellent. It qualified in all other respects. There's been a great deal of interest. Hundreds of children have expressed interest in attending this school, which would serve a lot of, frankly, underprivileged kids who aren't always getting the services they need. And for no other reason other than the fact that St. Isidore is meaningfully and distinctively Catholic, it's being excluded. It qualifies in every other respect. And again, this is not a form of discrimination that's required by the separation of church and state. Our Constitution and Oklahoma's Constitution, correctly understood, permit these kind of cooperative arrangements. St. Isidore wouldn't involve the establishment of a state religion. It would just mean giving parents and kids more options, and it's their choice whether they choose to attend this school or not. So again, a disappointing ruling. I hope that on appeal or further review, it's turned around, because I think school choice is proving in our day to be a really effective engine for educational reform and increased opportunity.
Yeah, really quickly before I let you go, can you talk about, you know, what comes next? And do you think this could potentially end up at the Supreme Court?
Well, it's a legal question that certainly could. Whether it does in this case or not, I really can't say. I want to defer to those who are actually representing on the case. But the question presented here, namely whether the Supreme Court would retreat from this non-discrimination rule that it's been so clear on these past few years, that's one that I think they'd want to address. And my prediction is that the Supreme Court would say that the Oklahoma court got it wrong.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. Rick, great to be with you. Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you.
All right, now to Kenya, where thousands of people have stormed the main parliament building in protest of new measure to raise taxes amid an already high cost of living. Demonstrators say they want lawmakers to vote against the new taxes. Today, members of parliament voted to pass the bill, then fled through a tunnel as protesters stormed the building, eventually setting it on fire. Earlier, police battled protesters in the streets of Nairobi with tear gas, and one of those gas happens to be the half-sister of former President Barack Obama.
I'm here because look at what's happening. Young Kenyans are demonstrating for their rights. They're demonstrating with flags and banners. I can't even see anymore. They're being tear gassed.
The former president's half-sister joined the protest, speaking out against the taxes. The country's Catholic bishops urged the government to listen to the citizens' pain. A contingent of foreign police officers backed by the United Nations has arrived in the violence-torn country of Haiti. The security forces are mostly from Kenya, and they will face violent gangs that control 80% of Haiti's capital. The violence has left nearly 600,000 people homeless. This arrival marks the fourth major foreign military intervention in Haiti. All right, now to the mounting tensions in the Middle East, where Israel's Air Force struck Hezbollah military buildings and other terror targets Tuesday in southern Lebanon. This as Israel's Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, is in Washington, D.C., and met earlier today with U.S. counterpart Secretary Lloyd Austin, who told Gallant that he is in part, quote, extremely concerned about the rise in rocket attacks on Israel's north from Lebanese Hezbollah and the recent surge in tensions. And joining us now to talk more about the situation in the Middle East is Simone Leedon, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. Simone, good to see you again. A lot to get to. But first, let's talk about what's happening between Israel and the Iranian proxy Hezbollah. Some fear the fighting could escalate and actually turn into a full-scale war. What are your thoughts on this?
I agree with those people. I think there is quite a high likelihood that these tensions will continue to escalate, and the potential for a full-blown war is increasing every day.
And the U.S. Has warned Hezbollah that it can't restrain Israel if this situation continues to heat up. Meanwhile, the terror group says that it's not going to agree to a ceasefire unless there's one in Gaza. And as we know, there hasn't been a resolution there yet. Simone, where do you think this is going?
Well, I think, frankly, I think it's a bit absurd to tie a Hezbollah ceasefire to a Hamas ceasefire when it's obvious. It's just disingenuous, because it's obvious there will not be a ceasefire with Hamas, because Hamas is not giving up the hostages. Once again, as we've said many times, Hamas could end this war tomorrow by giving the hostages back, but they will not do that. And so the Israelis are pursuing this war until they get their hostages back. And so until that time, there is no ceasefire. So it's, again, disingenuous and means they don't really want a ceasefire. And in fact, we see that by the increase in rocket attacks in the north of Israel.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, back here in D.C., Secretary of Defense Austin met with Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. What was your big takeaway from that meeting, and what does Israel hope to achieve?
Well, I thought the fact of the meeting was very important. I think it's important for Israel's enemies, who are also our enemies, by the way. It's important that they see the United States and Israel working together, talking together, and frankly, planning together. I think it's also important to note that the American, Secretary of Defense, said that we would not be able to restrain Israel. I think the language on that is a little odd. I think the restraint should be coming from a terrorist group, not from a nation state that is obligated to defend itself and its citizens. So I would have liked to have seen a little bit different language coming out of the U.S. Secretary of Defense. But I still think the messaging and the visual of the two defense ministers together is an important one.
Yeah, and I quickly want to get to this. Secretary Austin mentioned to reporters that diplomacy is really the best way to prevent further escalation, something that Gallant said he was working closely with Austin on. Simone, how optimistic, though, are you that there will be a diplomatic resolution to this soon?
I think there's about a 0% chance there will be a diplomatic resolution to this, unfortunately. Brings me no joy to say that. I think in the past 3 years, the Biden administration has done everything possible to present a policy of appeasement to Iran and its proxies. And I think it's played out to the situation that we see today. So it has not only not worked, it has failed spectacularly. And we see ourselves in this situation due to this misguided approach, which they're still clinging to and is just taking us closer and closer to a big, big regional war.
Yeah, so concerning. Simone, so great to be with you. Thank you so much for analysis. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, a judge in New York has modified the gag order for former President Donald Trump. Trump is now allowed to comment on witnesses and jurors in his New York hush money criminal trial. He is barred from discussing court and prosecution staff. The former president's lawyers were hoping to have the gag order removed entirely. A prosecutor shared several new photos of what they say are the documents seized at the former president's Florida home in 2022. The Department of Justice says that it found boxes with contents spilled all over the floor and personal mementos were mixed in with sensitive government materials. The former president's lawyers say the boxes were tampered with. All right, now to Mexico, where following the high-profile election earlier this month, challenges remain due to violence from drug gangs. 5,000 people recently fled one town in southern Mexico. It marked one of the largest displacements since the 1990s. Most doors and windows remain locked in the town as soldiers and police guard the town's entrances. A former resident emptied his home and left, saying there's no signs of life anymore. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including fighting gender ideology, how a case set to take up at the Supreme Court may affect efforts to protect children from so-called gender-affirming care. And the Surgeon General of the United States declares a new public health crisis. We'll tell you all about it. Welcome back. This week, the U.S. House is readying three more government spending bills to take up this week. House Republican leaders have all allowed GOP members to include a number of pro-life and family provisions. But this is just the early stages of the process, so a lot can happen before they're signed into law. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with the latest. Eric.
Good evening, Tracy. This is in the early stages of the process. The bills provide funding for defense, homeland security, and the State Department. They also include provisions restricting abortions, immigration, and LGBTQ programs. Republican Rules Committee member Congressman Ralph Norman of South Carolina tells me it's a good start.
We're happy that we're getting some of the Diversity Act and inclusions out. But the pro-life is very important and has to be in there.
Congressman Norman says he hasn't heard House Democrats will try to block them, but Republicans are going to make them vote on the floor.
But I think the country is tired of their annex saying they're not going to support it. One thing Mike Johnson is doing right is making them vote. Let's see how it turns out.
Right now, there are similar efforts going on in the Senate. Several pro-life senators wrote to the leaders of the Appropriations Committee urging them to continue banning taxpayer dollars for abortions and keep other pro-life provisions. The letter states in part, quote, a procedure intended to end a human life cannot credibly be considered a form of health care. A majority of Americans, including majorities of Republicans and independents, oppose the use of taxpayer dollars to bankroll abortions. We respectively call on the committee to retain all longstanding pro-life provisions. Democrats disagree and call abortions needed health care.
We need to fund the government, but they can't have poison pills that are further banning abortions, that are further discriminating against the LGBTQ community, especially with Pride, that are further banning books. So let's fund government and have a clean bill on it.
The best solution here is to codify Roe v. Wade into law and to continue to put judges on the court that actually wish to respect the law.
Speaker Mike Johnson hopes to pass all 12 spending bills by the August recess. However, that may be a tough ask as lawmakers gear up for the 2024 election. Some are telling me that these bills will pass in a lame duck session after the election. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Catholic Charities for the Diocese of Trenton is apologizing for co-sponsoring a, quote, beyond the gender binary book reading for children. The book features a boy who attends a school dance wearing a dress. The diocese says that it is reviewing what led to it co-sponsoring the event at a local library. Well, reaction is pouring in after the Supreme Court announced that it would consider a case regarding Tennessee's ban on so-called gender-affirming care. The state attorney general said in part, quote, we fought hard to defend Tennessee's law protecting kids from irreversible gender treatments and secured a thoughtful and well-reasoned opinion from the Sixth Circuit. I look forward to finishing the fight in the United States Supreme Court. And for analysis, we turn now to Mary Rice Hassan, the Cato Byrne Senior Fellow and co-founder director of the Person and Identity Project at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mary, great to be with you. First, your reaction to the news that the Supreme Court will consider the Biden administration's attempt to overturn Tennessee's ban. What do you think?
I think in many respects, this could be a great opportunity. The Tennessee was hoping that the court was going to leave the Sixth Circuit decision intact, which is favorable to Tennessee and to the rights of those states that have really sought to enact laws to protect minors from the serious consequences of these many irreversible consequences of so-called gender transition interventions. But this is a good opportunity because I think we're clearly in the right here and children need to be protected. So let's hope that the Supreme Court does the right thing here.
Yeah, and what do you think the White House meant by saying it's challenging the law on equal protection grounds?
Yeah, so their claim is that this law is not about child protection, but rather is a targeting of children who identify as transgender or gender diverse and are seeking so-called gender transition procedures. But really, if you look even at the text of the law is prohibiting minors, all minors, not one sex versus another, but all minors from receiving puberty blockers, hormones, or surgery for transition purposes. And the legislature did a really good job. They really dug deep, looked at the evidence, and came to a very reasonable conclusion. What the Sixth Circuit upheld as a rational basis for this law, that the evidence show is not clear. There are known risks that can be permanent, and there are many unknown risks. So the court said, Tennessee, and now it's about 25 other states that have enacted similar laws, have really done their due diligence and have done what states are allowed to do, which is to enact laws to protect children. The Biden administration is simply trying to do a misdirection here to say, no, this is some sort of discriminatory action towards children who identify a certain way. But that's not the way the law is written, and that's not how the Sixth Circuit saw the case.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Tennessee isn't alone here. I mean, there are more states that actually have some type of ban on providing puberty blockers and transgender surgeries for minors. That being said, how far-reaching do you think this case could be?
Well, it depends on which way. I think it's going to be far-reaching either way it goes. But I think the concern here is because the court took the question presented is limited to the equal protection analysis. That really drills down to the heart of the matter. And so we are going to see those on the left who are trying to elevate transgender identification into its own protected classification. They are really going to be pulling out all the stops and making their best arguments. But really, the Constitution's very clear. States have the power to enact laws that are designed to protect children. This is an even-handed law. It doesn't single out anyone. It simply does what legislatures are supposed to do for their citizens. It weighs the evidence, and it enacted a good law.
Yeah, and before I let you go, Mary, quickly tell us, what's at stake here?
Yeah, so for Tennessee, one of the really good things that they did was they extended the statute of limitations. So one of the things we've seen with young people who have gone through these gender transition procedures, that they and often their parents really didn't understand the risks. They weren't explained well. And it's not sometimes until they're of age or sometimes mid-20s even that they begin to realize what has been done to them. So the Tennessee legislature said, we're not only going to enact penalties on providers who attempt to do this, we are going to say, those of you who've been hurt by these procedures, you have the right to sue, and you have the right to sue for 30 years and after you reach 18, which allows for that growth, that maturity, and that chance to recognize the real harm that's been done. And that's a powerful thing. That will be a disincentive in itself. So I hope that the court will do the right thing. The law certainly supports the Sixth Circuit decision, and we will see where things land.
Yeah, we will. Mary, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.
Well, the U.S. Surgeon General says gun violence is a public health emergency. Dr. Vivek Murthy issued the advisory based on a growing number of injuries and deaths involving firearms.
But in recent years, over the last decade or two, this problem has been worsening, and we have now reached the point where gun violence is the leading cause of death among kids and teens, the leading cause of death. That is something that we should never take as the new normal.
The Surgeon General is calling on the U.S. to ban automatic rifles and to introduce universal background checks for purchasing guns. The National Rifle Association rebuked the Surgeon General's findings, saying that this is another step in the Biden administration's war against law-abiding gun owners. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a new perspective on the crucifixion.
Dali surrealism allows us to see God the Father's perspective on the crucifixion for the first time in an artwork piece.
A look at a unique exhibit showcasing the works of one of the world's most well-known artists. A recent exhibition in Rome examined the relationship between a famous 1950s painting by Salvador Dali and a sketch by a 16th century saint depicting the crucifixion of Christ. EWTN Vatican journalist Magdalena Valinska-Ridi has more.
A special exhibition in Rome titled Dali's Christ in Rome is bringing together the famous Spanish painter Salvador Dali and the Spanish saint and doctor of the church, John of the Cross. This is the third exhibition of the Jubilee Sculpture, the program of cultural initiatives in preparation for the 2025 Jubilee. Open to visitors at the Church of San Marcello al Corso in Rome from May 13th to June 23rd, the exhibition attracted more than 300,000 visitors. Salvador Dali's famous Christ of San John of the Cross is the exhibition's main piece.
The exhibition is receiving a lot of attention because it features one of the greatest works in art history, namely one of Salvador Dali's most iconic works. Clearly, the work in itself attracts, but it is also attractive because it speaks of a spiritual need in a world where it is often set aside.
The painting was named Christ of San John of the Cross because it was inspired by a small relic drawing by the 16th century Spanish Carmelite friar John of the Cross. The small ink sketch on parchment is itself believed to be a product of a mystical vision. The two works, which have never been exhibited side by side, can now be admired together for the first time. Completed in 1951, after his return to the faith, the painting and its unusual details were supposedly revealed to Dali in what he claimed was a cosmic dream.
Dali's Christ is a Christ who doesn't suffer. He is a beautiful Christ, a young and healthy Christ, depicted without any signs of the passion. The nails are missing, the crown of thorns is missing, and there is nothing written in the scroll above his head. The words, Inri, are missing.
The artist aimed at depicting how, despite gravity pulling the body downward, a supernatural divine force holds it to the cross. This force is the sacrificial will and love of Jesus, who willingly offered himself for the salvation of humanity. The painting, which depicts Jesus on the cross floating in the darkness over a body of water, is also the first one ever to depict Christ crucified from God the Father's point of view.
Dali surrealism allows us to see God the Father's perspective on the crucifixion for the first time in an artwork piece. We are used to seeing this event from below, as something we contemplate, and not used to thinking that God also has a perspective on the crucifixion and sacrifice of his Son. Thanks to this work, we can imagine the divine perspective on the crucifixion, on this weighty moment, which is the death of the Savior.
Besides its remarkable beauty, Dali's painting also conveys the theme of Christian hope, making it particularly fitting in the context of the upcoming Jubilee. In Rome, Magdalena Wolinska-Riedi, EWTN News Nightly.
And we thank her for that report. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.